And welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast, the podcast that brings some of the most interesting, inspirational, informative people on the planet directly to you. It's a great opportunity for you to listen in on these conversations, and if you love them, go to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating. This will ensure that the podcast gets to the ears of many, many more people around the planet. You can also share the podcast with family members, friends, people within your sphere of influence. Today's Hank Unplugged podcast is a very, very special one. Some of you remember that in the year 2012, I traveled to Iran. This was the 33rd anniversary of the overthrow of the Shah of Iran. I spoke at the University of Tehran in Allahmatabetaba. And during that time, I met many, many Muslims. And I have to tell you that even as I walked the streets of Tehran in the middle of the night, I met Muslims who showered me with acts of kindness. And for that reason, I oftentimes say that there are peaceful and tolerant Muslims in the world. However, as I indicated in my book, Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion, Islam is the only significant religious system in the history of the human race with a socio-political structure of laws that mandate violence against the infidel. And that graphic global reality makes Islam a religious ideology that espouses terrorism as a permanent policy rather than as a temporary expedient. And that has been the historical reality from the early 7th century Medina massacres all the way through the 9/11 21st century Manhattan massacre, and certainly beyond that. When I was doing research for Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion, I came across the myth of the Andalusian paradise. Dario Fernandez Moreira was an incredible author, as I found out reading through the book, but more than that, an incredibly courageous person who was not willing simply to tout the PC line, but to tell history as it really is. And he is my guest today. He holds a PhD from Harvard. He was and is an associate professor in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese at Northwestern University in Illinois. And he teaches courses in Golden Age and medieval Spanish literature. He is an author of the profoundly insightful book that I just now referenced, again, The Myth of the Andalusian Paradise, subtitled Muslims, Christians, and Jews Under Islamic Rule in Medieval Spain. And his work focuses on medieval Spain from 711 to the end of the 15th century. Professor, it is wonderful to have you on the broadcast today.
Thank you, Hank, for inviting me. It's a pleasure and an honor to be in your program.
Well, I was so taken by your book. I felt it was courageously written. It was also exhilarating at times, particularly when you're using tongue-in-cheek humor. We'll get to that later on. But when did you realize that everything you thought you knew about Islamic Spain was wrong?
Well, it was probably over 10 years ago. I was doing some research on Cervantes and Islam. As you know, Miguel de Cervantes, the greatest writer of Spain and one of the greatest writers in the world, he had a lot of interaction with Islam. Most evidently, he was captured at one point during a trip to Spain by ship. He was captured by Muslim pirates from North Africa and taken to North Africa and turned into a slave there for about 5 years. But before that, he had been a soldier in the Spanish army. And he participated in one of the great battles of the world, the Battle of Lepanto, off the coast of Greece. The Greeks call it Naspakatos, but the name Lepanto from the Italians is the one best known. And there was a great battle in which the Christians, a coalition of the willing, as we would call it today, of Christians, faced a larger Muslim Turkish fleet and defeated it. And at that time, the Turks had the largest, most powerful army in the world, the largest fleets, and they were on the march. They had conquered Constantinople, today's Istanbul. They changed the name from Constantinople to Istanbul in the 20th century to try to erase its Greek origin memory. And then eventually they conquered, they completed the conquest of Greece and moved up the Balkans against the center of Europe. And we can talk about that later in the great battles of Vienna, for example. But yeah, I was investigating then the relationship between Cervantes and Islam. And then I realized that a lot of what had been written about Islam in Hispania, Spain, that's the name given to Spain by the Romans, Hispania. From that comes the name Hispania. Hispania, you can see the derivation there easily. That most of what had been written about the Muslims in Spain and the relationship with Christians and Jews was a fantasy or perhaps even a lie. So that was the origin of my interest in the topic, and then I began researching it for this book.
Did you have any sense when you were writing the book of the pushback that you would get upon its completion?
It became more evident that there would be pushback because in the course of my research, I came across the work of some scholars who had written before me, and they had indeed been attacked mercilessly. There's a historian in France. His name is Sylvain Guggenheim. And I believe in 2008 it was that he wrote a book called Aristote au Mont Saint-Michel. I don't think it's been translated into English. It's been translated into Spanish, but not into English, in which he showed that the Islamic heritage had not been that important for Europe, but in fact it was the Greek heritage that was fundamental for Europe. And that all this talk about how Islam saved the classics, Roman and Greek classics, and preserved them and handed them over graciously to Europe was nonsense. That those classics had never been lost to be graciously recovered or preserved. In fact, they had been commented upon and preserved for centuries in the Christian Greek Roman Empire. The incorrectly called Byzantine, but the Roman Empire, mostly of Greek culture. That's why I call it in my book the Christian Greek Roman Empire, and I discard using that name Byzantine. That all those texts have been preserved in the Christian Greek Roman Empire, and in fact were accessible to Europeans, and many translations took place of those texts long before the second or third hand translations from Arabic Spain went on to Europe. And he was attacked mercilessly in France for what he had written. And even an earlier Spanish Arabist, Francisco Javier Simone, in the 19th century, had written a wonderful book on the life of the Christians under Islamic domination in Spain. And his work could not be published while he was alive because liberal Spanish Arabists, who were very influential, made it impossible for him to publish his book. His book was only published after his death. So, yes, in the course of my research, I became aware of the resistance that would take place. But that's understandable, and we can talk about the reasons for this as we talk.
And I'm really interested in that. Let me just give everybody listening in a sense of what you were up against, or if you correctly posit history, what you're going to be up against. And I'm really interested in why you think we're up against this kind of PC narrative respecting Islam. But think about David Lewis. He's a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. And he talks about Islam's proud tradition of tolerance. Or you think about what James Rustin Jr. was saying when he was saying that tolerance in Islam is in perfect keeping with the principles of the Quran. Or you think about the former president of the United States, Barack Obama, talking about how Islam has a proud tradition of tolerance. We see it in the history of Andalusia and Cordoba during the Inquisition and so forth. And he is not just a politician. He is someone who is a proud historian. He talks oftentimes about his historical prowess. So here you have people who seem to know the facts, but are giving us an alternate view or perspective of history. Why?
Well, you have cited several people there, and perhaps their motivations in some cases coincide. In others, there are different motivations. And indeed, there are different motivations for presenting this view of a tolerant Muslim kingdom in medieval Spain, and one would need to write an entire book about this issue. I touch upon it in the introduction. I dedicate some pages to it, and I can only mention, you know, very succinctly some possible reasons. In the case of professors who teach Islam and Islamic history and Islamic culture, there is an element of self-interest there, because it's their subject. And we all love, well, most of us love the subjects that we investigate. I mean, I became quite passionate about this subject that I investigated. I become passionate about all the subjects I investigate. But if one dedicates oneself rather exclusively to the field of Islamic studies, then there is a natural tendency there to present that field to readers and students in a generally positive way. I mean, we may point at some drawbacks and so on and so forth, but generally we are going to present it with the conclusion that it's a positive period of history and a positive subject. There is that element of self-interest, of love for the subject. And the self-interest gets even more complicated, because you may know that for quite a while now, many Islamic studies departments in the most prestigious universities have received enormous amounts of money from Muslim countries, from Saudi Arabia, from Turkey, from Libya under Gaddafi, from the Qatar. A lot of those oil-rich nations have donated enormous amounts of money to programs of Islamic studies in universities like Oxford and Harvard and Yale. Yale has a new program on Islamic law, where the professors there will talk about Islamic law and the students will study Islamic law. So it would be rather inconceivable for those professors to concentrate on showing the problems with Islamic domination through the centuries, not only in Spain, but also from the very beginning in the Middle East, and the destruction of Zoroastrian Persia, today's Iran. You know, Iran was not always Muslim. The religion there was the religion of Zoroaster, and all that was wiped out. All that culture was wiped out, and then the Christian culture in the Middle East and North Africa, and in Asia Minor, what is today's Turkey, was also wiped out. And North Africa was largely Christian. All that was wiped out, and the Berbers were converted to Islam, and not by preaching, by the way. So there is a long history here that the professors would rather not go into in all its rather unpleasant details. Unpleasant certainly for us, but one has also to take into account the historical situation. For those who practiced Islam at the time, it was not unpleasant. I mean, they were faithful people who thought they were doing the right thing. So that's one important motivation. I'm not sure about Lewis's motivation. He's not a historian of Islam. He's a historian, but he may have his own motives. I cannot guess. And in the case of Obama, there were political reasons, and perhaps his upbringing as a child in a country mostly Muslim. I believe he even attended a Muslim school. So he has sympathy there. So you see, there are many motivations that are at work here, and in some cases more than one.
One of my favorite parts of your book is where you write that this myth of the Andalusian paradise can hardly be explained by linguistic ignorance. And I want to go actually into what you specifically said and then ask you piece by piece to elaborate. So it can hardly be explained by linguistic ignorance, since the primary medieval Latin, Spanish, Arabic, and Hebrew sources required for a good general understanding of Islamic Spain have been translated into accessible Western languages, languages like Spanish and French and English and German, and in some cases, more than once. But then you say what it can be explained by is what economists call stakeholder interests and incentives, which affect the research of academics in the humanities no less and perhaps even more than those in the sciences. There may be other significant factors in play as well. Perhaps it has to do with what psychologists call motivated blindness, which inhibits an individual's ability to perceive inconvenient data. Perhaps it has to do with the innocence of intellectuals. Perhaps it is simply the result of shoddy research by a number of university professors, repeated by many journalists. Or perhaps since the 18th century Enlightenment, the critical construct of a diverse, tolerant, and happy Islamic Spain has been part of an effort to sell a particular cultural agenda, which would have been undermined by the recognition of a multicultural society racked by ethnic, religious, social, and political conflicts that eventually contributed to its demise, a multicultural society held together only by the ruthless power of autocrats and clerics. I was so fascinated by that part of your book, I virtually memorized it. In fact, I did memorize it. I think it's absolutely fantastic because each one of the elements, I think, bears real contemplation. So let's start with the linguistic ignorance. You say it can hardly be explained by that, and you give the reason why.
Yeah, because the basic texts have been translated. Some of those texts have been translated into English by very good scholars, by academics. Some of them have been translated into Spanish. Some of them have been translated into French, and some of them have been translated into English, Spanish, and French. And over time, there are some earlier translations, 19th century translations, early 20th century translations, more recent translations. So all that material is available there. It's like the Quran itself, as you know, it's been translated many, many times. So anyone who wants to know what the teachings of the Quran are has access to that because the translations are out there. So again, this apparent ignorance or willing ignorance, in some cases it's unwilling, in some cases I believe it's willing ignorance, cannot be explained by ignorance of the necessary languages. And I'm talking here not only about the Arabic sources, I'm talking here about Christian sources, which were extremely important for the research on Islam in Spain. In fact, the earliest and perhaps the most trustworthy source we have for the Islamic conquest and its immediate aftermath is a Christian chronicle, not a Muslim chronicle. And it's not written in Arabic. It's written in Latin. And that chronicle has been translated into Spanish, and I believe there is also even an English translation. So when I talk about that it cannot be explained by linguistic ignorance, I'm not only talking about Arabic here. Yes, it's important to read the Arabic sources, but it's also very important to read the Christian sources, which again were not written in Arabic, they were written in Latin. And a number of the Jewish sources have also been translated into English. There is a chapter there in which I deal with the Jewish community, and I use the works of Maimonides, you know, the great rabbi and philosopher, and his works have been translated into English, certainly, and or even Spanish. So that's what I meant by not being explicable because of linguistic ignorance.
And then you mentioned stakeholder interests and incentives, and I'm particularly interested in that.
Stakeholder interests and incentives, that's what I was mentioning earlier. You know, if you are a professor, you know, of Islamic studies, you have a stakeholder interest in the subject you're talking about. It's your bread and butter, man. You're making a living out of it, and presumably you love the subject. And then there is the other stakeholder interest factor, which is all that money that is going to Islamic studies. And as you know, that impacts science. Even scientists and departments of science may be impacted by the money that they may receive from even government and other entities in their research. So, yeah, stakeholder interests that affect the humanities perhaps even more than science, although science also is affected by this. Look, there has been research on scientific papers. I think I cite that in one of the notes of the book by meta-scientists. In other words, a scientist who studies the work of other scientists. And in some fields, it has been found that over 80% of the papers, scientific papers, published in scientific journals cannot be replicated in its conclusions. So even in science, we find this, to use a phrase that is rather fashionable now, fake research. So.
And I think what you're saying, in a sense, and probably needs to be underscored over and over again, accentuated in our minds, is that people don't come to issues with a white lab coat on, as though they don't have any biases. They do bring their biases, and there is a responsibility, therefore, on the part of the consumer to think critically about issues.
Of course. I mean, when I started my work on Cervantes and Islam, I came to it already with an appreciation and a love for Cervantes. So of course, one already comes to a field with a certain amount of knowledge and predispositions. And what one should try to do as a scholar is to try to examine the facts and present them as best as one can to the reader, for the reader to make up its own mind. And I try to do that in the book. I try to present the sources. I quote them extensively. Many books on the subject do not quote extensively. They just tell you what the researcher has found, and then that's it. And then move on and maybe give you a footnote as to where the researcher found the material that makes the researcher say what he says. But I don't just say what I say. I also quote very, very abundantly the sources on which I based my statements. So that's important in research. Yeah.
So even when you look at academics, then you find that it's very, very difficult for academics coming up not to go along with the groupthink, to be independent of their thinking. It's difficult. If you're tenured, you have a better chance than if you're coming up through the ranks, it seems.
That is true. Tenure protects you against possible eventually losing your job. But that is going to affect those who get tenure, because it means that from the beginning, the academic is being channeled into certain directions. If you deviate too much from those directions, then you are not going to be impacting the profession in such a way that you will get backing when the tenure decision comes. So that is a fact in academic life.
I want to go on and talk about what you call motivated blindness, which inhibits an individual's ability to perceive inconvenient data. What do you have in mind when you say motivated blindness?
Yeah, there are many instances of that. For example, if we love a person deeply, we tend to overlook the failures of that person. That's very common in a lover. You know, a lover loves a beloved and doesn't see the problems in that person that perhaps a friend who is not in love with that person may see. Or is often the case with parents. You know, they love their children, so they don't see their drawbacks. I mean, how many times we hear about someone who has been arrested for committing some horrible deed and then actually seems to have a history of committing bad deeds, and the parents say, oh, but he was such a nice kid. You know, even the teachers may say something nice about that person. Oh, but he's such a good boy, you know. I can't believe that he did that. Did he do that? I can't believe it. So there is that element of motivated blindness, yes. So that's an example of it.
You sort of say innocence of intellectuals, I think, tongue-in-cheek.
Well, I took that phrase from a Marxist researcher who described that to explain basically why not more intellectuals are Marxists. Many of them are, but apparently he was unhappy with how many intellectuals are not or are pro-free market or something like that. So he used the phrase, the innocence of intellectuals, to which he himself apparently was not subject to. So, yeah, there was this innocence of intellectuals in the case of the field that we're talking about here. Yeah, some intellectuals may be innocent and unable to perceive the reality of things. It's possible.
So shoddy research, this really strikes home with me. In 1999, I published a book called The Millennium Bug Debugged. At this point in time, there was Y2K hysteria, and people were writing books, and they had whole cottage industries going on with respect to selling freeze-dried foods and generators and all this kind of thing. And as I started looking at the millennium bug, or Y2K, I found a lot of sophistry and sloppy journalism and sensationalism and even script torture, where Christians were taking the scriptures out of context, torturing the scriptures to come up with a basis for forwarding this whole idea of the millennium bug. Well, I wrote this book, and in this book, I say that Y2K wouldn't even be a top 10 news story in the year 2000, because I looked at the data, and the data simply pointed to mining the subjunctive, finding the seed of threat buried in each unrealized instance. And so I write this book, and boy, it was the wrath of the world that came down on me, but only for a short period of time, because by the year 2000, all of the sensationalism and all of the sloppy journalism and all of the sophistry was exposed. In your case, you were fighting a far more difficult battle. So the shoddy research that is repeated by journalists militates against what you have written, and so the pushback continues for you, it seems.
Well, the shortest research, actually, I list in the book. You may have noticed that each chapter and frequently each section within a chapter begins with one or more quotation from a respected academics. So the shorty research that led to the statements that I quote is literally exposed there.
What about selling a particular cultural agenda? I mean, why in the world would we be selling the cultural agenda that Islam is actually good for Western civilization? I mean, you just look, for example, at the impact of Islam on women. It just seems counterintuitive to me that people are being politically correct by saying Islam is a peaceful and tolerant religion, and it ought to be practiced as people see fit within Western culture, which would mean, by the way, that a man could beat his wife, because that's approved by the Quran.
Well, selling an agenda. That, again, can have several motivations. For example, in the 18th century, the so-called Enlightenment movement was very much anti-Catholic. And so as part of presenting the dark side of Catholicism, mostly in Spain, but not only in Spain, it was logical to present some kind of alternative, or contemporary alternative, to that darkness, and presenting the Islamic Spain as a beacon of enlightenment was logical in order to deprecate Catholic Spain. So that is one example of the selling of an agenda. And so the Enlightenment people had an agenda. They want to push Enlightenment ideas against the retrograde obscurantist Catholicism of Spain. But over time, the agenda takes different forms. And perhaps today the idea is to sell a particular political viewpoints that require not presenting the Islam of past centuries as anything but positive, or at least certainly not, shall we say, not as bad as other people may think it was. So that's also selling an agenda, the selling of an agenda factor here at work.
We hear a lot about Islamophobia, but what about Christophobia? You have these gratuitous comparisons of the Islamic State's current terrorism tactics with the terrible deeds committed with Christians during the Crusades and the Inquisition, as though the two have a lot in common. They actually don't. But yet, it's easy to hear people being denigrated as Islamophobic, and very, very hard for people to accept that the culture is becoming increasingly Christophobic.
Well, what happens is a matter here of rhetorical success. I believe it was someone in the 20th century who came up with the term Islamophobia, whereas before, I don't think any Christian had come up with the term Christophobia. Had you heard of it before?
No.
I hadn't. So you see, it's also a matter of rhetoric, like so many things are. And if you get the right rhetorical terms, then you can create a certain narrative. So it's very important to come up with striking words or phrases in the debate of ideas. And Islamophobia has been extremely successful. There is also a related term that has to do with medieval Islamic law, Sharia, and which involves one subject among many others, and that is the Bima system that was used to keep the subject Christians and Jews in a subaltern condition. And the Dima system was described as a system of protection. And the Dinis, those who were subject to the Dima, described as protected people. Now, that was a wonderful rhetorical trick, if you will, of the Arabic language at the time, because it presented these people as protected. So what cannot be more wonderful than having the protected people? So, of course, Islam in Spain was wonderful because it had these protected people. Of course, you may wonder, protected from what or from whom? And then things, when you ask that question, things get more clear. Protected from those who implemented the Dima system on Christians and Jews, because the Dima system was basically a system of extortion and a system to keep the Christian and Jewish populations in a subaltern condition, a subaltern juridically, politically, militarily, and even sexually. And we can go into that fundamental aspect of what I wrote in the book, and also about the Islamic conquests, if you want, later on in our conversation, or now, as you wish.
Yeah, I mean, expand on that. And I also would like you to expand on some of these other words or phrases. For example, you mentioned earlier Byzantine. That's actually a pejorative.
Yes, it is. And that, again, was a rhetorical trick. This rhetorical trick was committed, if you will, or if you want to praise it, I mean, it's praiseworthy. It was brilliant by, I believe it was a German scholar in the 16th century, a Protestant scholar, to refer to the Christian Greek Roman Empire, which, of course, he didn't want to call it a Greek Empire, because that would connect them too much with the classical Greeks, which the humanists in the 16th century in Europe, of course, admired. So you don't want that. And you don't want to call it Roman Empire either, because already in Europe we had the Holy Roman Empire. And you don't want that empire there competing with this empire here. And probably the Catholic Church didn't want to call it either the Roman Empire either, because, Rome is Roman, but you mean that there was a Roman Empire over there? Not possible. So this contributed to the eventual use by scholars and everybody practically of the term Byzantine. Byzantine Empire, and the Byzantines did this, and the Byzantines did that. Well, no. The Byzantines didn't do anything because they were not called Byzantines when they were supposedly Byzantines. They were called Romans. If you read the Islamic texts, the Islamic texts refer to the empire as the Roman Empire and to the inhabitants as the Rum, because the Islam and the Christian Roman Empire were in conflict, almost from the beginnings of Islam. So that was a conflict of centuries between the two. And but the enemies, these Islamic enemies of the empire, called it the Roman Empire. And its inhabitants, and they called them a Rum. And the Europeans referred to the inhabitants as Greeks, because that was a culturally Greek empire. It was the Eastern Roman Empire, but the culture was Greek, not Latin. I mean, the lingua franca there was Greek. The culture was Greek. So it's nonsense to call them Byzantines. But you see, it's another successful rhetorical trick, call them Byzantines. And they non-existent, just because the city upon which the capital of that empire eventually was founded was indeed called Byzantium, but it was a small village, a small town, was of no importance. And then Constantine the Great built the great city of Constantinople and made it the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire. Apparently, mythologically, the inhabitants should have been called Constantinopolitans. That would be too complicated a word. So Byzantine is much, much handier. So that's how it came about. And, in scholarship, you read about Byzantines and Byzantium, And what are you? What did you feel? Well, I'm a Byzantinist.
Yeah.
It's marvelous. I mean, that's a good example. I'm glad you zeroed on it. That shows how scholarship can be affected by rhetoric, by the words we use, and the narratives that are associated with those words. And this business of Byzantium and Byzantines is one of them.
Yeah, and it's not just changing the words. I mean, that's one good trick. The other is taking the same word, but then pouring a different meaning into the word. And I say that because another really favorite paragraph of mine in your book is where you say it, talking about jihad, it is certainly possible that for centuries, the medieval Muslim scholars who interpreted the sacred Islamic texts as well as the Muslim military leaders misunderstood this word, the primarily peaceful and defensive meaning of jihad, and that as a result of this mistake, Muslim armies erroneously went and always defensively conquered half the known world. Or perhaps these conquering Muslim armies, and they were somehow merely exerting themselves to resist temptation to overcome evil. So you have this idea now that has so permeated the culture that jihad is actually the inner jihad. Well, there is truth to that, but it's the skin of the truth stuff with a great big lie.
Yeah, yeah. What academics are teaching in their classes, by and large, is that jihad is principally, mainly, as you cited, an inner struggle of the believer to resist temptation and improve himself and make a better person of himself constantly in life. And of course, there is also this other meaning of making a holy war, but that's not the main meaning. And they insist, look, we have to know Arabic, because jihad in Arabic, what it means is struggle. So what it means is this struggle to improve ourselves. And of course, there is also the other meaning of struggle in the sense of war, but that's a secondary. That's the little jihad meaning. That's what they call it, little jihad, as opposed to the big jihad or important jihad, which is to improve yourself. But indeed, what happens in history is that the great thinkers of Islam and the great leaders of Islam, and I have to try to avoid saying the political and military leaders of Islam and the religious leaders of Islam, because that distinction is again a Western distinction. In medieval Islam, there was no distinction between a political and military leader and a religious leader. The political and military leader was also a religious leader. The caliph was a religious leader. Of course, there were also individuals who dedicated themselves mostly to explaining the religious text, you know, the ulemas and the imams and so forth. But the leaders, the military leaders and the political leaders were also religious, as well as the imams and the experts in the textbooks and so forth, in the religious book. They also consider a jihad in the sense of religious war the principal meaning. I mean, if one reads the texts, the medieval texts, what they talk about when they talk about jihad is a religious war. This business of improving oneself is not talked about in these texts. I mean, it existed because, you know, it's part of being a good Muslim. But what these texts talk about is not that. They talk about religious war. But now that has been inversed. And now the principal meaning of jihad is this self-improvement process, which, I said that not entirely tongue-in-cheek. It is possible. I don't know what to what percentage that can be, but maybe there is a 1% chance that those people were wrong and that the professors today are right. But for my research, that did not matter, because what the texts of the time and what the leaders of the time thought and acted upon was jihad as holy war. So that's what we should be concerned with when we talk about jihad in connection with medieval Islamic Spain, and as a matter of fact, in connection with the conquests of Islam And by the way, the many of the professors who push this idea of jihad as self-improvement, they don't use the word conquest. They were sort of expansions. You know, the Islam was expanding. And so it expanded and conquered Persia, Zoroastrian Persia, became Islamic, conquered the Middle East, which was largely Christian, some Jewish minorities, but largely Christian. And it became Islamic, conquered Syria, where for the first time the name Christians came up in Antioch, as you probably know. And all of Syria became largely Muslim, lo and behold. And then North Africa was largely Christian. That was the land of Tertullian and St. Cyprian of Carthage and St. Athanasius of Alexandria, one of the great thinkers of the church. And Augustine, St. Augustine, was also from North Africa. So all those areas were Christian. Lo and behold, they became Islamic as well. So all these transformation was achieved through jihad, conceived as holy war. Believe me, it was not achieved through those warriors acting as trying to improve themselves. Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they were improving themselves in the act of making war. Hey, you can use that. Your professor can turn things around. Yeah, they were improving themselves in the act of carrying out holy war, because holy war, indeed, I'm serious here, indeed, holy war improves the believer. It is part of the improvement of the believer in the eyes of Allah to carry out holy war. So they indeed were improving themselves. There you have it.
Yeah, well, and to your point, I was just looking at the Reliance of the Traveler, which, of course, is a classic manual of Islamic sacred law. It's endorsed by top modern-day Islamic scholars. And you read this, and you see that most of Sharia law is devoted to prescribing what it means to wage war against non-Muslims. The scriptural basis, and now I'm quoting directly, the scriptural basis for jihad prior to scholarly consensus is such Quranic verses as fighting is prescribed for you. Slay them wherever you find them. Fight the idolaters utterly. I have been commanded to fight people until they testify that there's no God but Allah and that Muhammad is the messenger of Allah, and perform the prayer and pay the zakat. To go forth in the morning or evening to fight in the path of Allah is better than the whole world and everything in it. So this is directly from a classic manual of Islamic sacred law. And what it points out, and maybe you can expand on this a bit, but what this points out is that for 14 centuries, there's a track record. Islam has always progressed by sword. The inverse is true of Christianity. Christianity has always progressed by word. And where there are anomalies, they are indeed anomalies, because Jesus Christ, in his teachings, did not say go out and convert the world by sword. In fact, he said quite the opposite. If you pick up the sword, you're going to die by the sword. Whereas Muhammad, he invoked his warriors to conquer by sword.
Well, again, in my research, I did not explore the Quran itself. I'm not a Quranic scholar. That was not my interest, and it was not necessary either, because what was important was to look at the juridical manuals that the Muslims in Spain, that Muslims in the medieval period were using to guide their actions. So we're talking here about the Sharia, not the Quran, but the Sharia itself, as it was understood then, and I always have to make this qualification here. I'm not talking about Sharia now. Hey, Sharia now, maybe if correctly interpreted, means something entirely different. But Sharia as was written in the manuals, in the medieval manuals, and obviously interpreted by the Islamic scholars, and interpreted by the military leaders, was very explicit about the importance of jihad that you mentioned in that manual there. There are differences in some of the teachings in that manual regarding other things, and the teachings in other manuals regarding other things. The Guide of the Traveler is not a Maliki school of Islam manual. Maliki school was the one used in Spain, and still used in some parts of the Islamic world, but the Maliki school of Islam was the one that prevailed in Spain. But as far as the meaning of jihad is concerned, what you read there is the way the Maliki manuals in Spain interpreted jihad. In the manuals that I have read, at no point do those manuals talk about jihad in the sense of self-improvement. And an expert scholar on Islamic law, certainly on medieval Islamic law, Felipe Mayer Salgado, Spanish scholar, Arabic and Islamic law scholar, points out in his writing that indeed all the treatises that all the Islamic treatises in medieval Islamic Spain, when they talk about jihad, they talk only about holy war. There's no mention of jihad as a jihad, as a self-improvement and so forth. So yes, that is the case. It's fundamental. Now, the problem is that in some cases, you don't need jihad because the infidels may submit and they either convert to Islam willingly or they willingly accept their condition as beneath. So not always one has to go around with the sword. The thing is that the sword is the alternative there if the dhimmi doesn't accept the condition of dhimmitude, which, by the way, was imposed only on Christians and Jews. The rest, if you're a pagan, you don't have the three choices of convert to Islam or become a dhimmi or get the sword. You get only two choices. You convert to Islam or you get the sword. And in some areas of today's Islamic world, Islam was propagated by the travelers and the business people. But those were sort of exceptions to the rule. I think it happened in Malaysia, Indonesia, one of those places, where Islam came largely because of peaceful means. It was brought by commerce people. But in the parts of the world that we are concerned with here, the Middle East, Persia, today's Iran, Greece, Asia Minor, North Africa and Spain, it was carried out by jihad as holy war, by the sword. Yeah.
I'd like to alliterate what you just said by shahada, subjugation, or the sword, and it really brings out something that you just alluded to, that if you say the shahada, then you become a Muslim. And you often do that because you're living in a particular context that if you are a Christian, the penalties for the subjugation are so great, if you're not really committed, you don't want to pay the penalties. So you become Muslim. And that's one of the ways in which Islam grows. Another way in which Islam is growing today is migration without assimilation. That's been called the python swallowing its prey with a long and slow digestion. I wonder if you want to weigh in on that. I mean, if you think about the fact that Islam is growing so rapidly, they're growing rapidly demographically because Muslim men are allowed to marry many, many women. And so you have, in essence, in much of Western civilization, you have a demographic demise where native populations are dying out, and filling the vacuum are millions and millions of polygamous Muslims who have no intention whatsoever of assimilation.
Well, let me go back to the area of research that I am more familiar with, which is medieval Spain. I mean, the other areas you have mentioned I have not really researched. I probably know as much about them as you do or the educated listener. But in the case of Islamic Spain, the conquerors, again, gave the population the choice, the three choices. You either convert to Islam or you accept the dima or you get the sword. And what happens is that the initial resistance by the Christian kingdom there was destroyed at one main battle, the Battle of Guadalete, around 711. And then it was a disaster. And some cities resisted, but those cities that resisted got the sword. And that's an example. What happened to cities that resisted was that the men were killed or enslaved, the women and the children were enslaved, and the cities were burned. So what happened then is that most of the nobles, the Christian nobles, and most of the church leaders, who, as you know, always are looking for peace, you know, they decided to submit to Islam and enter into this pact, this Dima Pact. And what did the Dima Pact entail? Well, the Dima Pact, made a substantial part of the Sharia of the times. And it dealt precisely with these Christians and Jews who decided to submit rather than fight or flee. Many fled. Many of the Christians fled to the north. But those who decided to accept the pacts became a dhimmis. And becoming a dhimmi placed you in a subaltern condition. And that is a condition of subalternity, religiously, politically, militarily, and even sexually. And I'll go into that eventually, the sexual part. But let me give you a couple of examples that illustrate this condition of subalternity. According to the Sharia, the part of the Sharia that had to do with the Dima, if a Muslim killed a Christian, even intentionally, he must not suffer the death penalty. On the contrary, if a Christian killed a Muslim, even in self-defense, he must be killed. You can see there already an example of the condition of subalternity in which the dhimmi was placed. Or, for example, in a juridical conflict between Muslims, you could not bring in a dhimmi as a witness because the testimony of the dhimmi was not accepted in a juridical case involving Muslims. But in a juridical case involving Muslims and Christians, the testimony of the dhimmi was worth only half of the testimony of the Muslim in the juridical case. And by the way, it was equal to the testimony of a Muslim woman. The testimony of a Muslim woman in medieval Islamic Spain was worth half that of the testimony of a Muslim man. So those examples illustrate, I mean, there are many others, all along the whole range of human activity was regulated along those lines, placing the knee in a condition of subalternity, of inferiority, vis-a-vis the Muslim population. And this also extended to the sexual area. A Muslim man, as you know, can take four wives if he can afford to or wants to go into that. And he could marry a Christian woman and have children with her. But those children had to be brought up as Muslims. However, a Christian man could not even approach a Muslim woman. So what happens then is that the Muslims are marrying Christian women and having children with them, and the children are becoming are brought up as Muslims, who in turn, if they're males, marry other Christian women and bring up the children as Muslims, and so on and so forth. But the Christian cannot do that. You can see how that affects demographics, mathematically speaking. And that is a factor that has not been mentioned in the relatively rapid Islamization of the conquered countries. This is a sexual fact, the inferiority of the Dini, sexually speaking, contributed to the demographic expansion, the rapid demographic expansion of Islam. In Egypt, for example, the vast majority of the population in Egypt was Christian when Islam entered. But after a few generations, the Christians became a minority and are a constantly being reduced in number in Egypt. I think the Christians in Egypt now are about 10% of the population. So this impacts the demographics, even without large numbers of conversions, which also occur as a result of the social and other kinds of inferiority of the Dini. The Dini may decide, hell, I might as well become a Muslim, you know. Imagine a young, you know, male Dini, you know, full of testosterone, you know, he's likely to, well, might as well become a Muslim. And of course, there were also other sexual factors at work here. The fact of the possible four wives, although, you know, the records show that not every Muslim had four wives. However, a Muslim could have an indefinite number of sexual slaves if he can afford them, buying them and keeping them. So even if you don't marry, you can have sexual slaves, and you can have children with those sexual slaves, and those children had to be brought up as Muslims. And those sexual slaves in Spain were largely Christian sexual slaves captured in the jihad against the Christian kingdoms and brought to be sold in the slave markets. Umayyad Spain, Umayyad Islamic Spain, was one of the main exports of Umayyad Spain was slaves exported from Cordoba, mainly, or the cities as well, to other parts of the Islamic world. So slavery was fundamental for the economy of Islamic Spain. So you can see how this also impacts the demographics. Now, there's a reverse issue here, which is the impact of sexual slavery on the Islamic population of Spain, because many of these invaders, initially they were a minority, so they kept marrying Christian women, but also getting the sexual Christian slaves, to the point that the rulers of Spain, their appearance, as they are described in the Muslim chronicles, was very on Arabic. They frequently were blonde, and they had blue eyes, or they had red beards, very, very white skin. So they showed the impact of this Christian sexual slavery on the rulers of Spain. So this is a complicated issue when you talk about the demographic growth of Islam in the Middle Ages, and that's what, of course, I have investigated.
Yeah, it's really well communicated. I want you to maybe turn a corner here. This is related, but talk about the difference between Islamic Jihad and Christian Crusade, because there are so many attempts, as you've noted in your book, to equate jihad with crusade. But if you actually look at the details don't cooperate the story or the narrative.
Well, of course, because as you pointed out, jihad as holy war is part and parcel of what a good male Muslim should do with his life, which doesn't mean that even in the Middle Ages, you know, every Muslim became a warrior. You could help in other ways. You could help with money and other ways. But the ideal way was to take the sword and get on a horse. So it is mandated by the juridical texts of the medieval period But if you examine the juridical texts of Christian Europe at the time, you don't find the equivalent there. There's nothing in those juridical texts that say that to be a perfect Christian, you have to take up the sword and get on a horse and go fight the enemies of Christianity. That is sort of an exception to the normal state of things. In other words, where the normal state of things under the Sharia of the medieval times in Spain and elsewhere is that jihad as holy war is part and parcel of you being a good Muslim, you don't have that as part and parcel of being a good Christian. What happens is that at certain periods, and as a result of the attacks of Islam against Christianity, rulers of Christian kingdoms prompted and supported, and I repeat again, prompted by the Pope, carried out wars, religiously sanctioned wars against the enemies of the Church, namely Islam. And that is the origin of the Crusades. People think that the Crusades came out of nothing because they start their thinking the moment the Crusades start. Look at those Crusades attacking the Muslim world. But they don't look that before the Crusades, there was this long period of assault of the Islamic Empire against Christianity. Of course, also against the Zoroastrian Persia and also the Hindu-Buddhist in Sindh. There were other places where Islam was attacking and expanding and conquering and transforming. But let's concern ourselves with Christianity. The Islam had been attacking Christianity for centuries. And those attacks were first against the Christian Greek Roman Empire, which was the empire in the Middle East and in North Africa and in Asia Minor and in Greece. So it was against those Christians that Islam began its military, political, religious, every kind of expansion. And they defeated the Greeks early on in history in the 7th century. They defeated them at the great battle of Yarmouk. I don't know if you've heard of that battle. Yarmouk. It's one of the most decisive battles and perhaps important battles in the history of the world. And they defeated the Roman Empire at that battle, and it was a crushing defeat. And as a result, the empire lost the whole of Palestine, the Middle East, and eventually pretty soon after that, they lost Syria, Damascus. All that area fell in the hands of Islam. But there were no crusades yet. The so-called Byzantines were alone fighting the Muslims. And then this nation from Asia came into the picture, the Turks. The Turks came from Asia, from Central Asia, came in contact with Islam and converted to Islam. And they became soon the main force within Islam, not the Arabs any longer, but now the Turks. And these Turks continued the attack against the Christian Greek Roman Empire and defeated the empire in another big battle, very important battle, called Manzikert, either in Syria, in today's Syria, or in today's Turkey. I forget now what the geographical boundaries are there, in that area there. Defeated the empire, another crushing defeat. And the Greeks had to retreat. They had to abandon the whole of Asia Minor and retreat to Constantinople and Greece. And then the Turks entered what is today's Turkey, and of course now it's called Turkey. And it was under the Turkish assault that the emperor of the Christian Greek Roman Empire called upon the Christians in Europe to help him against the Turks, who now were really at the gates of Constantinople. And it was that why the Pope at the time, the Roman Christian Pope, Urban II, I think it was, called upon a crusade to help the Christians, our fellow Christians, and beat back these desecrators of the Holy Land. And by the way, before the Crusades, there had been an attack by one of the caliphs of Islam against the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. I think it was burnt. And of course, that eventually was known in Europe, and that didn't create a very good feeling against Islam in Europe. But that did not provoke a crusade. It took several decades after that attack on the Church of the Holy Sepulchre for the Christians in Europe to organize themselves into the First Crusade. That's the origin of the crusade. It was a defensive war to help the Christians in the Middle East. But as you said, there is nothing in Christianity that commands the believer to carry out a sword and fight the enemies of Christianity. That doesn't mean that, and that's a matter for theological discussions, I'm not an expert in that area, that doesn't mean that Christianity doesn't allow for self-defense. No. Or even for the carrying of weapons, by the way. That may be even allowed. We can talk about that later if you wish. That's not the topic, and I'm not an expert in that area. You're more of an expert in that area than I am. So, yes, there is a big difference between jihad in Islamic teachings, at least in the Middle Ages, and carrying out a holy war in Christian terms, again in the Middle Ages. Today, of course, that may be different, and that may not be the case in Islam. Again, you know, that's again possible. Well, there you have it.
Here's something I wanted to ask you about. I don't know if you subscribe to this or not, but so if you just sort of broad brush on history, within decades of the death of Muhammad, you have this jihadi juggernaut conquering Egypt, Syria, and then by 711, you have Arab armies that have defeated the king of Spain and in less than 10 years controlled most of the territory. But if Jan Sobieski, the Polish king, hadn't halted Muslim expansionism at the gates of Vienna, September 11, 1683, the whole of Europe could have fallen to Islam as well. So my question is, do you think that there's any veracity to the notion that Osama bin Laden purposely chose September 11, 2001 as a way of saying we're back? We didn't conquer Europe then, but we're going to conquer Europe now. Maybe not through violence, or maybe not through jihad, maybe through a demographic war. I don't know. But do you think that there's any possible validity to that?
I hear that possible connection, and it's possible. It's possible because many Islamic thinkers have always thought in terms of centuries, you know, rather than isolated actions. It's a relentless effort, if you will, to make the earth submit to Islam, not convert to Islam, because that's a mistake. Islam doesn't necessarily ask you in the Middle Ages to convert. It asks you to submit. That was one alternative. You could convert, of course, but you could also simply submit and accept the supremacy of Islam as a religion, as a political force, and so on and so forth. And then you as an individual become a dhimmi within the dhimma system of Islam. But you don't have to convert. You only have to submit. So the idea is by the true believer in the Middle Ages was to make the entire world submit to Islam. So it was, if it doesn't happen in my life, it will happen eventually. All I can do is contribute to it the best as I can in this life. That was the impulse behind the Islamic conquests. Because many professors today who are materialist historians dismiss that and say, well, you know, it was really because of certain economic factors, demographic factors, all sorts of material reasons except what we should correctly call spiritual reason, because it's a faith. You may not like what the faith represents or what it teaches, but it is a faith. Or you may say, well, it's the wrong faith, but it is a faith. And that faith was a tremendous motivator in the Islamic conquests, and it proved decisive in many cases because these warriors were willing to die. It was a win-win situation. If you fought and did not die, but of course you would win, you would get all these goodies. You could take the property of the defeated. I mean, that's within the Sharia of the times. You are allowed and be encouraged to take the property of the defeated, and that includes his women. But if you die, then you also win, because you get all these goodies in the afterlife. So this was a tremendous motivator for those warriors at the time. And it gave them a tactical advantage against an enemy who was not similarly motivated. That changed with the Crusades, because then the Christians became equally motivated. You see, the Pope decreed that a Christian who died in battle, fighting against the enemies of Christianity, would have his sins dismissed. Now, that was a great motivator. Again, historians explain the Crusades differently. Oh, well, you know, there was this excess of population in Europe, and there was all this greed, you know, to go there and get stuff. Because most historians are not religious. I mean, many may be, but frankly, I never met a historian yet, an academic historian, who is a very religious person. So religion doesn't seem to play a factor in the mind frame of many academics. So they don't even think of this as really a motivating force to make you willing to die and kill, if necessary, for your faith. That's not the way. I mean, these people did not think academically. They were not professors. They were warriors motivated by a very strong faith. And that, I think, was a factor in all these victories, and eventually became a factor for the victories of the Christians, because the Christians, as you know, eventually beat the Muslims back in Spain. That is the so-called Reconquista. And the Reconquista was sanctioned by the church authorities. And you're fighting here for your religion, and you're fighting here for your wives and your children, who are also Christians. So it is perfectly fine and commendable and praiseworthy that you take up a sword and you fight the Muslim warriors and kill them. Killing them is good, because you're defending yourself. You're defending your religion and your families and your people. And that's how the First Crusade was successful. I mean, the First Crusade beat them and recovered the Holy Land for Christianity for about 100 years, until the Muslims, you know, regrouped and launched their counterattacks and eventually beat the Christians. And then the other Crusades failed. And the fourth one, instead of attacking the Muslims, attacked the other Christians in Constantinople, attacked the Orthodox Christians. So you had the Roman Catholic Christians attacking the Orthodox Christians and sacking Constantinople. That was a disgrace. But anyway, so yeah, religion is important, but in different ways for both sides.
Although I would say that it is sometimes a misnomer to call Islam a faith or even a religion. I don't think it's a religion in the Western sanitized sense of the word religion or the thought of religion. It's an all-encompassing socio-political legal matrix that has bred a worldview antagonistic to anything but itself. I mean, you've pointed out that it's relentless. It seeks to conquer the world. So often it's thought about as a religion, but I don't think that's really what it is. It's a socio-political, it's an economic system that runs on the rails of Sharia.
Well, I'm not sure if I agree with that. It is a religion different from Christianity. it is a religion different from the pagan religions of the ancient Greeks and the ancient Romans, for example. It is a religion different from that of the Buddhists or the Hindus. But I think it is a religion with tenets which are different from those religions, but there are some tenets which coincide with those other religions. So there are differences and similarities. What happens is that a lot of those who the same ones who dismiss jihad as holy war dismiss the parts of this religion that make it look less like a religion to Western eyes, and that's why they try to blur those elements and present only the others, which make it look more like a religion according to Western eyes. But look, I think that even people who were pagans and made sacrifices to Zeus and so forth, they had their religion. It was just a different one from other religions. So I would still call it a religion, but I can see why you would want to not to give that honorable title, if you will, to Islam. I would still call it a religion.
Well, and I think you can argue that it's a composite faith with pagan, Jewish, and Christian elements. But the point I'm making is that people oftentimes forget that they are ultimately, as Islamic people, governed by a system of laws. That's the nub of it, as it were.
Yeah, that's one big difference. And there are two things to point out here that you have brought up. One is the legal difference in Islamic countries and the legal difference in Western countries, and that is that in Western countries the church has ruled itself by religious law, whereas the civil population has ruled itself by civic law. That is a distinction that has existed in Western civilization, and by that I include also the Christian Greek Roman Empire, which was not apart from Western civilization. In the Christian Greek Roman Empire there was a civil law and there was religious law. What happens is that in many cases both have influenced each other in the West, and you find that civil law in the West was impacted by Christianity, well, of course, and that religious law, or canon law, as it is more exactly called, has some elements of the civil system. But the civil system in the West was largely derived from Roman law. So it was a legal system that the Roman law, as you know, was not Christian. I mean, Roman law was developed by pagans. And civil law in the West was largely based on Roman law, with a number of Germanic customs, all of it impacted by Christianity. Whereas the law of the church was strictly religious law, canon law, and it was studied and practiced by priests. But that was not the case in civil law in Western countries, whereas in Islam the two are inseparable, and as is the case, by the way, also in medieval Orthodox Judaism. In medieval Judaism, all law is religious. There's no distinction. Same thing in Islam. Judaism was a religion, of course, but it made no distinction between civil law and religious law. All law was religious, and so was the case in Islam. So there is that important distinction between the Christian countries and the Islamic countries, where there is no distinction between the two. So yes, that's important. You mentioned something else earlier, and I forgot now. I was going to elaborate on that. What was it that you were talking about earlier? the two things that you mentioned. Could you recapitulate the statements you were mentioned just earlier in regard to Islam not being a religion?
Oh, yeah. Basically, what I was saying is that Islam is not a religion in the Western sanitized sense of the word, that it's actually a legal matrix or something that runs on the rails of Sharia, that ultimately Islam, I mean, I also mentioned that it is a composite religion, so there's a
which... I wanted to zero in on that. That's the thing that I wanted to talk about, which is that something very interesting happens in academia regarding the study of Islam and the study of Christianity. As you know, since at least the 19th century, many academics have approached Christianity and its origins strictly from the historical and scientific point of view. You know, looking at what are the origins of the Bible? Well, basically, you know, it comes from this and this and that. It was not really some kind of revelation, you know. It's just historical origins, and then they have explained that and so forth thoroughly. I mean, so many books, so many great scholars have examined Christianity and the New Testament and even Christ, you know, as a historical figure, not as a religious, you know, son of God, go figure. But in the case of Islam, that doesn't happen. If you look at what the Islamic studies departments do, they don't study the origins of the Quran from a strictly scientific point of view. They sort of overlook that, or they don't study how come Muhammad came to be called a prophet? Why don't we study, you know, the real Muhammad, who he was? He was not a prophet. He was this guy who, you know, had certain interests and blah, blah. That doesn't happen in the case of Islamic studies in Western universities. That part is skipped. They don't touch that, which, of course, has been done repeatedly in the case of Christianity. But lo and behold, Islam seems to be immune to that type of examination about its origins. Not religious origins, but historical origins. Where does the Quran come from? Now, some scholars have examined the subject, but they have not been scholars in departments of Islamic studies. They have been scholars who are either retired, conveniently retired, or independent scholars. And there is this... this organization called INARA, and I will spell it, it's INARAH, INARA, and it's made up of these kind of people, retired professors or independent scholars who have examined the origins of the Quran, the origins of Islam, from a strictly historical and philological and even archaeological point of view. The problem is that they have had no support from universities, no support from governments, and lately they don't even meet. They are afraid to meet. So you see, this whole area of the origins of Islam has become a taboo in so many ways. Some books have been published. There is a great scholar in France, Edouard Marie Gallet. It's G-A-L-L-E-Z, Edouard Marie, and he's published some books on the origins of Islam. And he goes back to something you mentioned, you know, the origins of Islam in Judaism and in Christianity, so that the Quran is basically a composite of these borrowings from pre-existing monotheistic religious texts. So that's a very interesting area, you know, that is not touched and should be by specialists who know really well all these Middle Eastern languages, you know, Hebrew and Syriac and Arabic and all those. But unfortunately, it's not being pursued in Western departments.
There's something else very, very interesting I wanted to get to. This is sort of another linguistic sleight of hand, dark ages. We hear that term, dark ages,
right.
And we often hear that medieval Spain needed liberation from the Christian dark ages. But again, that's a spin in and of itself.
Yeah, no, that's another part of the myth. In fact, the Christian kingdom of the Visigoths in Spain, the level of culture was much higher to that of the Muslim invaders. Most of them were, most of the invaders were Berbers from North Africa, who had recently converted to Islam and whose cultural level was much lower than that of the Christian kingdom of the Visigoths. That kingdom had inherited, like so many other Germanic nations, it had inherited the culture of the Roman Empire, which by the time was already Christianized. As you know, the Roman Empire became Christianized officially in the, I believe, in the early 4th century, I believe it was, thanks to Constantine. And eventually Christianity became the religion of the Roman Empire. So by the time the Roman Empire in the West fell, and I say in the West, because in the East never fell until much later, it continued to survive. The so-called Eastern Roman Empire, or as I call it, Christian Greek Roman Empire, or as it's usually called Byzantine Empire. But in the West, the empire fell officially in the 5th century, in the 400s. And by then, the Germanic Visigoths had been allies of Rome. They fought against Attila, side by side with the Roman troops against Attila, the Visigoths. And eventually, they created this kingdom in Spain, this Christian kingdom. The Visigoths were Christians. Initially, they were Arians, was a heretical form of Christianity, but they were Christians. And eventually, they converted to Roman Catholicism, to the official Christianity. So they assimilated to the Roman Empire in their religion, but they also assimilated in their laws. The Visigoth Code of Law is basically a Roman law code with some Germanic elements and impacted by Christianity. And they also assimilated in the language. You know, they adopted a Latin, which evolves into Spanish eventually. So the Christian kingdom of the Visigoths in Spain had assimilated to the culture of the Roman Empire. And it produced great scholars. Saint Isidore of Seville is one of them. There were several of them who were experts in music. There were experts in the poetry of Ovid and Virgil. Theodulf was an expert on the poetry of Ovid and Virgil, and eventually fled to France and became a bishop there, and was part of the Renaissance of Charlemagne. So this kingdom was a very well-cultured kingdom. One of the kings had even built a city called Recopolis, and archaeologists have discovered in that city aqueducts and baths and coinage, printing and paved streets. And it's totally the opposite of what people think of the Dark Ages and how these Islamic invaders came into Spain and civilized them. No, on the contrary. So that is nonsense. But even in Europe itself, aside from Spain, this Dark Ages is another myth. You know, there were quite a number of advances in the Dark Ages, you know, technical advances. So yeah, that's part of the misinformation, this Dark Ages thing.
I want to ask you one last question, just in the interest of time, but this is a really significant one from my perspective, and I'm sure from your perspective. Historical illiteracy. I think about what Hitler said. He cynically anticipated the collective amnesia of the modern world when he said, "I gave death orders to my units to exterminate without mercy or pity men, women, and children belonging to the Polish-speaking race." And then he said something that is always stuck in my memory. He said, "After all, who remembers the extermination of the Armenians?" So here you had this mass extermination, but because of collective amnesia, because we didn't know history, there was historical illiteracy, people are able to continue with horrific atrocities. So maybe as someone who is steeped in history, at least a particular period of history, you can speak to the importance of historical literacy on the part of kids going to school, etc. Talk about the importance of history.
Yes, it's fundamental, and today it is more and more not taught. properly, and the example of the Armenian Holocaust is one of them. And the one factor that I remember is the fact that Turkey became an ally of the United States. Turkey became part of NATO. So it was politically the wrong thing to do, to insist on the Armenian genocide. So the Armenians have been pushed aside, and of course the Armenians, look at those people from the east, you know, who cares? But there was also, there was this element of political necessity or desire to not to mention things like the Armenian genocide, and of course there were other factors from other people to make mentioning the Armenian genocide the wrong thing to do. So there are political factors at work, self-interest factors at work, sheer ignorance, the wrong teachings, often prompted by some of the other factors that we have mentioned. So there is this lack of historical and cultural literacy. The topic you started our conversation with, Byzantine, is one of them that illustrates the problem very, very well.
Dario Fernandez Barrera, when I think of your name, when I think of your book, The Myth of the Andalusian Paradise, I think brilliant, courageous, you're a great writer, and obviously a very interesting speaker as well. And I deeply, deeply appreciate the contribution you've made to Hank Unplugged and to the audience all around the world that'll hear your words. Your book is just fantastic. And by the way, I want to mention to everyone listening in, that book available to anyone that wants to support the Christian Research Institute, just check it out on the web at equip.org or write me at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. But I deeply, deeply appreciate you. Your book, again, was brilliant, and the conversation was stimulating.
Well, Hank, thank you for your word, but I was really impressed with the kind of questions you were asking. They were pointed and to the point. So I really thank you for inviting me and congratulate you on the astuteness of the questions that you asked.
Well, thank you. That's high praise coming from you. And again, the book, The Myth of the Andalusian Paradise, available for anyone who supports Christian Research Institute. And do remember that if you've enjoyed this conversation, so informative, so enlightening, go to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, and share this podcast with family members, friends, people within your sphere of influence. In the process, you'll be making a difference for time and for eternity. Thanks for tuning into this edition of Hank Unplugged. Look forward to seeing you next time with the next edition, another interesting guest coming up right around the corner. So long for now.